When you are pioneering anything or introducing new ideas to the culture,
you get criticized.
You do?
Yeah. Did you hear about that?
I didn't find the one. I found someone I respected, and we made it the one.
In a sort of longing kind of view of love, people understand each other as if by magic.
Nothing in itself is addictive, on the one hand. On the other hand, everything could be addictive if there's an emptiness in that person that needs to be filled.
I now know that nobody changes until they change their energy. And when you change your energy, you change your life.
I'm Gwyneth Paltrow. This is the Goop Podcast, bringing together thought leaders, culture changers, creatives, founders and CEOs, scientists, doctors, healers and seekers, here to start conversations. Because simply asking questions and listening has the power to change the way we see the world. Here we go.
Hi, it's Kiki Koroshetz, VP of Content at Goop. For this week's episode, we're sharing a really special one from our archives. In 2018, shortly after we launched the Goop podcast, Gwyneth sat down with her own mom, actress Blythe Danner. This conversation is full of such sweet and beautiful moments. I hope you'll enjoy revisiting it as much as we did.
Thanks for coming on the Goop podcast.
Oh, my darling, I can't believe you asked your mother.
Of course.
You don't even return my call.
Yeah, I'm right.
how I got into this, I'll never know. Why am I sounding like your father? I'm trying to do a Brooklyn accent. He's here.
He's with us.
He's
somewhere.
Hovering.
He's hovering in the room. And so when I was thinking about questions that I wanted to ask you, I feel like I got so much of my femininity and creativity and artistry from you. And I'm just really curious about when you felt that in yourself and kind of the path that it put you on.
Well, what about your father's pink cashmere socks? And
we're not talking about my father. This is not about him.
I'd rather talk about him and you. I had no consciousness of that. No, I was raised in a household where in the 50s, 40s, you were expected to be daddy's little girl. And my mother, as you know, was very conscious of bows and
external appearances.
Yeah. I think music had such a major chord in my life and our family's life. Those were the happiest times I can remember.
What was it like?
It was an escape to something that was joyful and, you know, all families are complicated. And if there was any stress or it was a way, my father had a glorious voice, so did my mother and my brother, and we all sang. And we would harmonize and harmonize.
Anybody play the piano?
Yeah, my brother played the piano.
And would you all kind of gather around together and sing?
As you know, at our parties, that was the main attraction. And my parents would have parties that would go. My mom tried to once have a Christmas party. She always did invite somebody at 5 to 7, 7 to 9, 9 to 8. People did that long ago, and nobody would ever leave. They'd all wait for the singing, and they had opera singer friends, and the house was just so full of joy.
So your father was a banker, but he was also, he moonlit as an opera singer?
As a singer in different churches and with the Philadelphia Chamber Orchestra. Mom and Dad met at the Philadelphia Choral Society. So they just, that was just such an important part. And I guess I don't remember any conscious femininity. I think it was just because I was, as a matter of fact, I think my mom was disappointed because she would have me all dressed up in beautiful little crinolines and hair perfect. And 2 minutes later, I was a mess because I was a tomboy.
I mean, I guess the way that I mean femininity in this context is sort of that connection to yourself and the softness and the imagination and the art more than like physical femininity.
Yeah, I know, but I am not that deep. I can't go there. No, I just remember wanting always to escape somehow myself. And that didn't have, I wasn't an unhappy family. I mean, it was a lot of, as I say, everyone's complicated. But I remember staring into the mirror and saying my name over and over and over. And all of a sudden I'd go whomp into the, I'd go into outer space. And I loved being somebody other than me.
And you were hypnotizing yourself?
I guess it was. And I think that's why I was so drawn to acting ultimately.
Yeah.
I told you I was listening to your friend the other day on NPR, Tandy Newton, who was saying she was so happy to escape into acting because she didn't have to be herself. And I remember how surprised I was when you told Katie Couric you were interested, drawn to acting, because when you saw your mother, and then we won't talk about me anymore.
Oh, sure.
When you saw me on stage, I was seen much, so much more powerful than I was in life. And that really startled me because I'd never consciously thought of that. But it's absolutely true and accurate. I think a lot of actors are drawn insecure.
What do you think you wanted to escape from when you talk about escaping?
Myself. Because I think, unlike you, thank goodness you have a good, strong part of your dad. And I think you came into the world with a very strong self-image, and I couldn't harm that. I may have tried to sway you to, you know, being more conforming to what I thought was the proper young girl. And you were a rebel from the beginning, but thank God. I mean, when I think of your extraordinary talent as a little girl. You knew my speeches before I did it, too. We were Williamstown with Chekhov and harmonizing, speaking of which I would do a simple third above the melody. And you were doing it, too, sixes and sevens and harmonics. I'd do double takes and say, what? Who is this? The piano teacher threw the book away, said, I can't teach her a thing. It's all by ear with her. And you just always... And you had a strength and you knew who you were. And I should have been wise enough. And that's what still bothers me, that I didn't have the wisdom, which I think your dad did, to observe, to know that you were this creature, unlike anything I knew, this combination of our crazy genes, possibly.
Do you think that, I mean... When I think about you being little and being a tomboy and loving music, it sounds a lot like me. And so I just wonder, do you feel like, because your mother was so strong, do you think she sort of disconnected you from yourself in some way? Like, did she kind of suppress that, or you were trying to kind of be what she wanted you to be and you lost something?
She encouraged, I mean, she was very funny and, you know, she encouraged the music and she encouraged creativity. It's just that as I don't know, wish I knew exactly how to answer that. I don't remember her suppressing those things.
Well, there was a lot of, like, blaming and shaming,
well,
right?
Yeah. I mean, I, you know, German Lutheran background. I mean, and I was very religious growing up because to me, you know, Luther League and going to church and again, the music was what was so wonderful. My brother and I would walk home singing. So there was that element, yeah, which is also probably why I chose your father, who was antithetical to all of that.
It certainly
my
was.
Wild man, my irreverent Brucey. But I wouldn't blame, I mean, I guess that's very difficult when you know, everybody has an element of that in their family. There are very few families, I think, that are without that
Absolutely.
Element of discord or blaming.
Yeah, that's true.
But I really did adore my mom, especially.
I don't know why.
Well, I know you have your issues. But I did too. But, you know, she ruled the roost and the men were kind of in the background compared to mom.
For sure. I think that, you know, looking back, putting aside the fact that I didn't have a very good relationship with her, there was something very powerful about her. And I think, you know, she sort of created this line of feminine energy that we're all still working off of and through. In her case, she probably could have, you know, expressed it in a healthier way. But also, to your point, I remember you saying that she was incredibly musical and a brilliant performer, and she was very much suppressed.
That's right.
So tell me about that.
Well, she was discouraged from her first marriage. They were in Germany. That side of the family, my half-brother, William Menick and son, they're 13 generations of violin makers, and each son would go and study with the person who taught them in Europe. That was a tradition for many, many years. And mother was there we called him Uncle Bill. We were all very close, even though they were divorced. It's kind of a little bit of conscious uncoupling there.
That's right. Now you know where I get it.
Yeah. She was a dazzler. She was really beautiful. I mean, I always said she was the prettiest of certainly of our generation and hers of all of her sisters. And she would walk into a club and they'd strike up, "Dinah, is there anything finer?" And she was in her element with her frou-frou, you know, her ostrich feather thing. And she just adored it. And she was asked to record with a band in Germany. And her husband, I think he discouraged that. So I think she was frustrated.
Yeah.
And sort of through me, wanted me to be a glamorous actress and have long red nails and bleached hair. And couldn't understand why I was attracted to these non-glamorous roles.
You're definitely more alternative than your mother.
Yeah. That and politically, too. I mean, my parents were Republicans, and they were furious with me when I registered as a Democrat. I went to a Quaker school, and my best friend's mother had been carried out of the Treasury Department on a stretcher during the Vietnam War, and, you know, bad mom. And, they didn't even want me to really go there, but to visit, but they grew to love them. But no, they were very
so you
very
were
different.
Still a very free thinker.
I think it was the Quaker influence.
How so?
Well, they're, you know, peace people. And that was really all that education that I had at George School and had been to a Quaker school in first grade. So I think it just kind of permeated.
I remember you taking us to Quaker meeting when we were little, and I loved it because they served Tang in the children's section downstairs. Remember, we used to go to Westwood all the time.
Until that strange woman wanted to wash your feet and pretend
I think
she was
married. It was a Jesus thing. I was kind of into it.
It was very, and it was the West Coast version
of Quaker,
not the Richard Nixon, but.
So you went to George School, you were thinking about, or you were being educated in this?
Socialism.
and peace and social responsibility. And did they nurture your acting there as well, or your music?
There was a wonderful acting teacher there, and that's actually where I started. Well, I was watching my parents at the Parent Teacher Association. They were so glamorous, and they'd dress up. Mom would dress up, and Dad had his tux on, and they'd entertain everybody with Jeanette MacDonald, Nelson Eddy, you know, dazzling. Poor Daddy could never remember his words, which I inherited, sadly, and he'd read them off his cuffs.
So when you graduated George School, where did
I
you...
I want to talk about you.
Mom, well, you can't talk about me. This is about you. I'm interviewing you.
You're my daughter.
Well,
all right.
Maybe later.
Go ahead.
The wait is over. That's right. Season 5 of The Kardashians is here. Just when you thought life couldn't get any faster, they're punching it into overdrive. Kris, Kourtney, Kim, Khloe, Kendall, and Kylie are back and continue to defy expectations in all their endeavors. So, get ready to go behind the glitz and glamour of the most iconic family on television. The all-new season of The Kardashians premieres May 23rd, streaming on Hulu.
So what happened after George School?
Well, after George School, I wanted to come to New York and be an actress. And my dad said, no, you have to either. You could go to Germany for a year because there was a very good exchange program. And I was friendly with the exchange student that year. Or go to college. And so I chose to go to Berlin, which was a bizarre year because it was the year the wall was beginning to be built. The people were escaping and shot out. We could hear them, our school, and it was very intense. And I, you know, wanted to. But I joined America House and a little group at America House. And as the people were escaping, they would come, some of them who managed to, would come to America House to get their papers processed and sit in the audience while we were up there performing things like, "I'm just wild about Harry." And they were sitting in tears.
Oh, my gosh.
Having just escaped. I always wish I could be a writer and really write about it. And I'd say, "Are they crying because we're so bad?" And they said, "No, they just escaped." So that had made a, quite an
Did
impact.
Did you have a boyfriend in Berlin?
I had a young friend, but not a boyfriend.
Not
I was
a boyfriend.
Really slow starter.
Really?
He was a wonderful, funny, poor boy whose mother had killed herself. I was very drawn to him. He was a dear lost soul.
Oh, dear. That's His what Dad used to call a fixer-upper. Yeah. We're not in the fix-em-up business.
Oh, my gosh. It. That's right.
So, but were you in love with him?
No.
No. It was just
a good, it was like a little brother.
So you had a whole year in Berlin.
Yeah, very long time. Unlike you, it's a short time in Spain. I wish they had them curtailed them a bit. I wish I'd gone to Paris, actually.
Did it feel too long?
Yeah, it was strange. It was a very odd, you know, it was a fraught time. It was fraught with all kinds of political upheaval and darkness. And it was not a pleasant time, no.
So you came back and you enrolled in Bard College.
I went to Bard College back in the days when it isn't as grand as it is now academically. Now it's hard to get into Bard. Then they just said, "Come, we need people."
Now it's impossible to get.
Yeah, but it was great. I mean, it was a weird.
What was the best thing about
terrific,
it?
Terrific, you know, terrific drama department. We would be doing Shakespeare out in the garden and have to hold with our arms extended doing Shakespeare while the train passed below. You know, it was wonderful. It was crazy and a lot of nutty people.
Yeah. You had a boyfriend there.
Yeah, a couple.
You don't want to talk about
nah.
it? Why not?
Oh, why?
Because
bother.
It's so fascinating.
Lots of laughter, which was great.
Okay.
But nobody
is
funny as your dad, you know. I have to say, when you were born, he always used these sports analogies, which I always went over my head. But they said when you were born, they said, "Oh, we want to take a picture. We always photograph." And Daddy said, "Forget about it. She looks like Rocky Graziano after the Sugar Ray Roberts fight. Because you had this beautiful large head, which didn't want to come through easily. You were all smushed."
So I was a hideous newborn,
well,
is what you're
hilarious.
Saying.
It was hilarious. He always had a sports analogy. And then he was racing up the Pacific Coast Highway to where we were living in Trancas. I was still in the hospital. And had these, got pulled over by the cops. And he had It's a Girl buttons all over him. And he jumped out and he said, "Forget about it. Not tonight. Not tonight."
Oh, my God.
He loved life more than anyone I've ever known.
I know.
Except maybe you. You got that
You're
from
jumping
him too.
Ahead.
Well,
I've always been curious about your romantic life before Dad, because, you know, Daddy was such a huge figure in your life and all of our lives. And so I always wondered, was there anybody else you ever loved?
Well, the fact, you know, it's funny. I don't know that I did.
Wow.
I think he was my big savior. You know, I met him and immediately just felt, this is the only person, and I adored my father and my brothers, but the first person who I felt was completely comfortable in his own skin. I don't think I had ever experienced quite that, because my dad was a great gentleman and always was incredibly kind and proper. Bruce used to joke, he came over and had his first Jewish meal, as he called it, you know, from Zabar's. He said he never unbuttoned his vest, his three-piece suit.
His first Jewish meal.
Bruce, I mean,
I love
first
it.
Bagel, and Dad had never had lox and bagels. And Bruce was very taken with him. He really loved my father.
You know what I wanted to know was, how did you start your professional acting career after college? What was the break?
Well, I'd been, you know, had wonderful time with at Bard and met, I had a great teacher there, Charlie Kakasakis, who said, people used to say it meant sheets of checkers in Greek, but it didn't.
Kakasakis.
Kakasakis.
Sounds like an ailment of the anus or something.
Well, then we had Niko Sakharopoulos. I was attracted to all these Greek, you know, from Williamstown. So Charlie said, listen, there's a great company, Fishkill, New York, and I'd like you to play Laura in the Glass Menagerie. He said, you'll get your equity card. I went, no kidding. So I played Laura in the Glass Menagerie and got my equity card. And then after that, I guess I went up to the theater company of Boston where Dustin Hoffman, Bobby Duvall, Ralph Waite, that was,
wow,
you know, and then Ben Affleck's dad was the stage manager.
Oh, that's
Timmy
right.
Timmy Affleck, who became a good friend. And so all of these guys were acting in this weird little cockroach-infected theater.
Was it in Rapp? What place were
it
you?
It was in the Terrain Hotel, which no longer exists. They finally tore it down. And it was repertory, yeah. And they would make up their mind the last week. You want to stay and play a whore, or do you want to be an angel this week? Or you want to be, you know, it was always something different. And you had a week to do these little one-act plays. And that was
I didn't realize. So when you went to do The Great Santini, you had already worked with Bobby Duvall.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, no, I hadn't worked with Bobby. I observed Bobby. Dustin and Bobby and Paul Benedict, all these actors were doing Waiting for Godot and The Cocktail Party. I was there really to observe. I didn't work with them.
And so you finished up there and where
and
did
then
you
I got my first role off Broadway was I was hired because I could speak German, and of all the girls that auditioned, they told me I was the only skinny girl who spoke German because I was supposed to be starving in the Second World War. So I got it by default. Everybody else were Brunhildes, I guess, who walked in. And then soon after that came, you know, I met Daddy and I went to audition for him. And he was hurling all these witticisms from the theater while I was trying to work up my emotion. I thought, who is this jerky guy? I'm supposed to cry. And he was just so darn funny. He was always. And then that kind of was it.
And then you got the lead in Butterflies Are Free.
Yeah.
And what was that like? Your first?
I actually didn't want to do it. You know, again, I thought I was such a very serious actress. And I read 17 pages and I said to Bruce, will you read this? I don't know. It seems awfully fluffy to me. And he said, well, go up and meet the director. And I should have really done more of this. I said, I don't know that this is right for me. Whenever I did that, I always was sought after. So the director, Milton Kaselis, another Greek, he said, you've got to do this. You've got to do this. Keir DeLay and Eileen Heckert. And so I said, well, I needed the work. So I did it, and I was astonished that it was a big hit. I was sure it wouldn't be.
And what was that like to be kind of the belle of Broadway when you were 26?
I wish I had enjoyed it more. I sort of felt I didn't. I hate to say it because it sounds sort of, but I assure you it's true. I felt I didn't deserve it. I felt I hadn't done enough. You know, I had just come out of at repertory and off Broadway. Just sort of thought, why am I doing this? And actually, Eileen Heckert didn't want me, after I won the Tony, she didn't want my name above the title because she said she hadn't deserved it. That's the old way that really, right. That's not casting dispersions on Eileen as much as that was really the thought back then.
Do you remember that night when you won the Tony?
I wasn't thrilled. Isn't that awful?
No, just it is what it is.
Well,
why?
The opening night was the night that Daddy asked my dad if he could marry me. And my mom wasn't thrilled about it. She thought he was stealing my thunder. I don't think that way. So to me, it was so strange. Stealing my thunder. It wasn't all that heady. I don't know why. I guess it's that Lutheran hair shirt thing.
Right. It gets deep, that psychology.
Well, you enjoyed your night, didn't you? Except for me, who was sort of a sourpuss.
It was a strange night. I mean, I think it's interesting that we both won these awards when we were 26.
That's right.
That's pretty It's a strange parallel.
Right.
I found it really overwhelming.
Yeah, but you had, until then, you'd won everything. SAG, Screen Actors Guild.
But it's really, at the end of the day, all about...
Well, you know what? With you, it came so easily to you. I was always astonished.
Acting?
Yes. You, as I talked about how you were so musical at such a young age. And you just, it was so deep within you. And I always thought, she doesn't have to struggle. I mean, you always got it. You knew the character, the accent, the core of the person. I mean, I was just astonished. And people, I had some women who actually said to me, are you jealous of your daughter? And to me, it was the most extraordinary. She was born of me. Why would I not be? Right. How could I be jealous of her? I was so incredibly...
And I got it all from you.
I don't...
Absolutely.
Daddy was very creative in his own right. He couldn't carry a tune, though.
No, he definitely couldn't. But it was different, you know. I mean, you talked about that thing that I said to Katie Couric, but it's so true. When I was little and always in Williamstown and watching you rehearse plays, and not only were you so powerful, but you seemed so on fire. You were just so impassioned and free, and you really showed me what the art of acting was, you know?
Oh, sweetie, it makes me sad to think that I didn't have any of that in my life. I mean, as a person, I don't think I did.
I don't think that's true.
Which is also a reason I chose your dad, because he was the one who was...
I just think you always felt far more comfortable on stage than you did off stage.
That's true. Absolutely true. And I think it's true of so many actors. I heard an interview with Maggie Smith years ago, who said she felt that she was alive when she was working and didn't know what to do with herself when she wasn't, which I thought was astonishing.
And so you had this beautiful, successful career, and then you got married.
And it was all downhill. Now, I really wanted to quit and raise children, but I didn't realize that I had enough cuckoo-ness inside that I had to have an outlet for it. You can't just sort of, at least I couldn't just shut off that switch. And I was not a good mother, I realized, unless I could have an outlet. Well, there was that creative part that I couldn't deny, that I was trying to find that fire in that life. And I felt that I did at times with you all, but I also would run away, wouldn't I? Which I have tremendous guilt about.
Why?
I think all working mothers, whether you're an actor or not, if you're drawn back to your work, you feel guilty. You feel you should be there 24 hours. But I couldn't function as a good mother unless I had that outlet. And I feel I really did damage to you guys at times when I really had to escape. I felt that I had failed.
Failed how?
By not being present all the time. As I found, I learned a lot from you, too late, unfortunately. But to be present, to be completely present. And I would sit there with you all and play, and then I'd say, I think I'm boring them. I've got to find something more enriching. I'm not enough. You know, I always had that stupidity.
Why do you think that so many women have this imprint that they're not enough?
Do you think it's generational, or do you think that everybody, even in your generation, has it? Because you're all so much more evolved than we were. I mean, you have so much more information. You've gone to therapy. You know, my mother said, you don't go to therapy. We come from a strong stock, which I always thought was the most bizarre thing to say.
Especially because she was like, well, bipolar.
No, I don't know. Who knows? But you sought it. You knew that you needed to have that. And look how you never stopped. You have more curiosity than anyone I've ever known. And your dad had that too. Your love of art. We were told you could be a great art historian, a lawyer. Your brain was so much like dad's, thank God. But your curiosity and your never-ending searching, look where you are now. you mogul.
Oh, please.
You're always on the search for...
I have like bags under my eyes and BO and... Exhausted.
You do not. When you work out and you're in great shape, but you never stop searching. And that to me is your greatest...
That's true. I am a searcher.
Yes.
I don't know. I wonder about that. I think my generation still very much carries that imprint. A lot of us do that we're not enough.
And why is that?
I think it's just transgenerational. I think it's just something that happened at some point.
When you were with the children all the time, as you were early on, did you feel that as now that you're, then you
no.
were doing film and working?
No, I felt that more in the pie chart of my life and the romantic slice. I always looked for confirmation that I wasn't enough through the boyfriend that I had.
You always were able to have rich relationships. Some of them didn't work out, but you
always... Yeah, but some of them were with very damaged men. When I had Apple, my experience of myself was completely transformed.
Yes.
And I felt like...
You were so in love.
I was so in love with
her.
I still am.
I know. And then you speak of... Then when you had Mosey, it went through the difficulty of...
Terrible postnatal depression.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I think was really shocking to me because I never thought that I would be a person who got postnatal depression. And I was so euphoric when Apple was born. And I assumed that it would happen with Mosey. And it took a while.
It
I really went to a dark place. Did you have any hormonal imbalance or anything after Jake or I were born?
I don't remember I did. I just know I wanted a lot of kids. I would have gone on and had, because I had great pregnancies and deliveries. And I just thought, this is so I wanted more because it would make me feel more full too.
Right. And
that, you know, I thought it would be great for you to have siblings and a big family. But Daddy always said, we're always going back and forth from coast to coast, and it's not good to do to kids. But I don't remember that. I just remember wanting more.
Do you regret not having more?
I do. I think it would have been great for you guys to have a family, more kids.
Yeah.
You know, really to take care of each other and be part of a big family. I know people who don't even speak to some of their siblings, you know, that came from big families. Yeah. I mean, it's also individual, that experience.
How did you reconcile working and being a mother?
I never had a conscious, I never had a game plan. That's one of the things about being an actor and without a producer talent or, you know, I never had a strategy or could I do this or could I maybe assemble a group of people to do that. I just sort of flew by the seat of my pants. And a lot of times there were terrible things that came up, you know, that before Daddy started doing so well, there were some TV movies I like to burn.
And everybody loves your Columbo episode. I hear that all the time.
Pregnant with you. So there was never, it was just kind of will of the wisp, let's see what's next. So I never really, and then I didn't, then we were in New York and I didn't do any theater for a long time.
Yeah, you were in LA working.
Yeah.
And on location. And you brought us to some fabulous places when we were little.
What's your best memory?
Beaufort. I loved when you did The Great Santini and we all lived in Beaufort. It's a really indelible. It's bizarre. I didn't realize I was so young when Hamlin O'Kelly was just over. I didn't realize I was only six. I remember it so clearly.
That made me kind of sad because you talk about that a lot being your favorite time of your life. And we were there 2 months at the most.
It's so funny. I think there was
the freedom.
There was a lot of freedom.
And camaraderie.
Yeah, it was really. And that Southern way is so warm and specific and
funny.
Right. It's true.
You wrote a note to my friend, to my beloved crab catcher, taught you how to
catch crabs.
You already had some of your eloquence.
What was your favorite role that you've done?
Well, probably Blanche and
Streetcar Named Desire
and Masha and Three Sisters and the Seagull. Nina, when you knew that speech at the end before I did, I'd been slaving on it for weeks. And you listened to it a couple of times in my rehearsing, and Men in Beef, Lions and Eagles, couldn't believe it.
And then we did the Seagull together.
Yes.
Years later.
Yeah.
Why are you making that
Well,
face?
Just because it was so different. I mean, it was, I was hard on you during that.
That's okay. I needed it.
I was not fair to you.
Why?
Well, again, it came so damn easily to you. And I thought you had to sweat blood and tears to give a great performance. And you never did. And I wish I had recognized your otherness and embraced it. You know, I could cry about the fact that I didn't. Daddy did. Daddy saw you. Well, you were such a big part of him, too. I think your DNA or your essence had so much of him.
Do you think it bothered you that I was sort of insouciant about the role and the part, or what was it?
It just came easily, and you didn't have to work hard at it. And I remember there were times you came in and kind of rolled your eyes and went, oh, again, we have to, or I already have that.
I still do that.
Oh, my God, you've got to bite into it. You got to go deeper. You got to hurt. You know, I mean, you were 19, first of all, to be playing that part. Nobody plays Nina at that. A very few people, I think. You can't tackle that role till you're 30 or late 20s. I mean, as far as I'm concerned.
I wasn't that good at it anyway.
It was a strange production, except for, well, I'd go anywhere to work with Chris Walk, and I adore him.
Oh, my God. Mom, do you remember that night he got drunk on stage with me?
I know. But you know what? As wacky as he can be, he is such a company person. His heart, he's always there to catch you. Unfortunately, not that night, because he just happened to be drinking.
This was when this is in the 90s.
Now,
and
he's
they
still
had,
alive. So
that's okay. We love him, but it's an empirical fact. He was getting these like cocktails in a can. Do you remember?
No.
And they were in his dressing room. And I remember thinking, my gosh, what is that? And then we were on stage and he was doing his giant monologue, and then he started weaving back and forth, and then he forgot all his lines.
And you were on the floor. I'll never forget that. And you saved it. You came in and you saved the scene.
Oh, God.
You came off, I remember, and I embraced you and said, oh, my God.
You were giving him coffee.
And then we gave him coffee downstairs and I told him deep. But he is a brilliant, brilliant talent.
Yeah,
and
he's amazing.
I would go anywhere to work with Chris. I've never met anybody as true as
an actor. So you loved working with Christopher Walken.
Love.
Who else? What are the other actors that you loved working with?
Oh, gosh. We had that company up there, Olympia Dukakis, and Louis Zorich, sadly, who just died, Lee Grant. Then we had, I adored working with Raul Julia. Best kisser ever on stage.
Ooh.
Really nice lips.
I love
and,
it.
Oh, there are tons. Bobby Duvall, you know, talk about being unleashed and going where he would just let it rip. He taught me a lot. The actors and the people who were rebels.
That's cool.
You included.
What was it like for you when I decided that I wanted to be an actor? Or when did you know that I wanted to do it?
You didn't really talk about it. It was funny. You would join the companies, you know, if they needed a little boy in Williamstown, you had short hair. And I remember Kate Burton said, I knew she was going to be a big star because she asked, you carried a dog on and you made an entrance in Cyrano. You made an entrance on your toes. And you carried a puppy onto the stage. And she said, I knew it then, the way she made that entrance.
Sounds like ham. Ham time.
You have to have a little of that.
Yeah.
But no, I didn't know. I guess when we were doing Picnic together, you were so great in that role as, what was her name?
Oh, I don't
remember. The ingenue.
No, and, I wasn't the ingenue. Jane Krakowski
Jane Krakowski, yes, but you
I
played
was the
her
younger
little
sister. Yeah.
with Tony Goldwyn, and what that was wild. And you, at the curtain call, people were stomping when you came on and cheering and carrying on. And Daddy and I had said to you before that you have to go to college, you have to go to college, you can act. But, and then I think Dad looked at me or just said, let's forget about it. She's great. So then you had our permission anyway.
To quit college.
Yeah.
I did go to college. I went to UC Santa Barbara for almost one full year. Well, I do want to ask you a little bit about Dad and your marriage and how the part that that played in your life and especially in your artistic life, because you guys, it was sort of like a boomerang. I felt like he would let you go.
He was very generous.
And you would come back.
He'd always say, I'll do the commerce, you do the art. You know, and then he had these wonderful shows, St. Elsewhere, The White Shadow. They were art in themselves. Someone said to me the other day, which I'd forgotten, that at Memorial that Steven Spielberg talked about Daddy and said, Bruce Paltrow was his art. I had forgotten that. He influenced so many people. I mean, to this day, people say to me, this is 15 years later after he's gone, they say, we often say, WWBD, what would Bruce do? He just was a non-ending font of support and help, you know, changed so many lives.
Yeah, he was very good at seeing in people what their special thing was and amplifying it.
I mean, a hairdresser came up to me long ago and said, your dad changed my life. I said, what?
Not your dad, my dad.
Your dad changed my life. I said, why? He said, well, I was sitting at a table with a bunch of movie stars and I thought I don't belong here and got up and went outside and your dad came out and said, what are you doing here? You're as good as anybody sitting at that table. Got in there. You know, he was a great egalitarian, and he talked to the guy who swept out the studio exactly the same way as he did the head of the studio or the network.
Yeah.
Every so often, he'd have a black and blue shin because under the table, I'd give him a knock.
You were so different, my God.
We were so different. People said we wouldn't last past a year.
I mean,
and then I look at our wedding photos, and everybody else was divorced.
You were the only ones who made it through.
Except my brother and his wife.
What do you think being a mother, how did it change you?
Oh, gosh. Well, as an actor having children, what I love the most about it is the focus completely just shifted. I was not my priority anymore. I mean, I didn't do it as well as I would like to have done it, but you were both my heart, my raison d'etre. I mean, this was all I'd wanted children from the time I was a little girl. Loved kids.
Why? I know you always think that you weren't a good mother, and I don't agree, but what would you do differently, do you think?
I would have, in your particular case, I would have been able to have, I would have sought the wisdom, therapy or whatever else, to see who you were, rather than try to mold you to something you weren't.
And what about for Jake?
And Jake was an easier child, you know? I think the boys in our family all seemed to be somehow less assertive or less, what's the word?
Confrontational?
Yeah. He was just easier.
Right.
But I was always, I mean, I see it in each generation. There's some of that.
Right.
To honor who you are. And I wish I had done more of that.
Do you feel like you honored who you were?
I hadn't even considered that. How do you mean?
Like giving yourself the freedom to really understand who you are and then giving yourself the freedom to fully inhabit
that? No, I was
that?
A dope. I didn't go into therapy. And if I did, I lasted a week with like six different people. It was just,
I just wonder how you would expect to honor who a little girl was if you weren't even fully honoring who you were. It doesn't seem like something to beat yourself up over.
Maybe I just came into the world that way. I always felt you came into the world as you were going to be strong and wailing. And here I am, world, you know? I just think, I think you really do. I'm not to diminish influence we have as parents, but I think you basically come into the world as you're going to be. You can be certainly guided. And
I think that it's really the environment that you grow up in is really important, especially
in early childhood.
And my philosophy with my kids has been, I agree with you in that I think they have come in with who they are, but then I think you can fuck it up.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's really an art, I think, to be a parent and to parent, try to parent consciously as opposed to out of instinct.
Yeah.
And
which you've done incredibly
well. Well, you know, but it's difficult sometimes, especially because Mosey and I are so similar in a lot of ways, and we have the same bad qualities. So sometimes I find it really triggering with him. And I always, you know, have to think like, okay, you know, try to put a pause in between what you're feeling and what you're going to do or say next. And I think, you know, you guys just came from a generation where you just didn't.
Yeah.
You didn't apply a philosophy through it, maybe.
And we also didn't agree. You know, some of our largest disputes were over.
You and Dad.
Yeah, how to rear. You know, I felt, no, they shouldn't get allowance until they'd empty the dishwasher and clear the table. And Dad said, oh, leave him alone. I mean, you know, even though he had his very strict areas.
We
never really, I think that's really important. And the only advice I would give to young parents is try to be as much as you can in the same ballpark.
As your co-parent.
Yeah.
Right.
Co-parenting.
Yeah.
Because kids, and you were so smart, and Jakey's so smart, you pick up on those things.
Yeah.
You often learn how to play them against one another,
oh,
too.
Oh, yeah. But, it's a child specialty.
Yeah. But it's really, that was frustrating to me, that we weren't always on the same page.
Right.
Dad was clearer. I think I was a little less clear about what I was trying to, and then I would have guilt about, you know, I was too rough.
What are you going to do? You know what?
What are you going to do?
The way I look at it is, for whatever mistakes you made as a mother, I look at those things that might have been confusing or hurtful or lonely or any of those set of feelings that any child has, based on the humanity of their parent, the humanness of their parent, those are the things that become building blocks. Those are the things that really...
You learn from.
Yeah, you really hone your focus and you think, wow, I want to be like that, like her in that way, and I don't want to be like him in that way. But I think all of the hurts that we go through, all of those sufferings are exactly as they're meant to be, and I'm very grateful because I feel like I grew up in a house with a lot of love, and you weren't perfect and Daddy wasn't perfect, but neither am I and neither is anybody.
And you forgive it.
I definitely have.
Somebody, where did I read the other day? It was such a great quote. I think it was from Maya Angelou. Basically, it was that you don't really forgive until you can absolutely let go.
Right.
Of all of the things that have been done damage to you,
yeah,
and just see the person.
I read a fantastic quote about forgiveness in the New York Times pretty recently, where it was a modern day philosopher, and they were saying that in order to really forgive, you have to let go of spite, and then constantly remind yourself about what is beautiful about the other person. And I had never...
Spite.
Yeah, because you hang on, you know, when you feel I was wronged, and I had never named it as spite before, but there's that sharp, hot feeling when you haven't forgiven somebody. And if you kind of go underneath the intention, it's, I want you to pay for what you did. And that's spite. right?
Yeah.
So you really have to let go of that.
Right.
And sometimes it's difficult to let go of that.
It's such a human instinct. No matter, I mean, even the people that I talk to who I really, you know, my peace lovers, my two best friends are, one is a peace worker and a potter, and the other is a social worker. And then I'll see, so peace loving, and then I'll see those things pop out and I, wow.
Well, we're it's all, true. I think also the tendency that we have to be reductive and say, one person is a peace worker, so that means she's not allowed to be a human being. And we all have anger and hurt. And
yeah.
We have to look at ourselves in that in a holistic way. And I certainly think that's what I try to do in the way I regard myself as a mother, because it's really hard. And I think it's easy to do what you've done in a way, which is look back with regret. And I don't think you should.
Mm. I'm still working on it. I have a few years left, I hope.
Plenty
I think
of
this
years.
Is the best conversation I've had with you since we lay in bed and made up songs. But thank you for giving so much of yourself to me.
Thank you for giving.
Being such an extraordinary human being, daughter.
Thanks, Mom.
Sometimes I think you can't be my daughter. I'm so proud of you.
Thank you.
And the search goes on, and you keep teaching me, too.
And you keep teaching me. What do you want for Mother's Day?
You already gave me that beautiful bag.
So?
I walk around like a bag lady with plastic bags, and my daughter's so appalled. So she ran out and got me a gorgeous bag, which I just carry all the time.
Well, we were at an appointment, and she came to it with...
Well, I'm always recycling everything.
You certainly are.
That was,
and I thought, this is no way for Blythe Danner to go to an appointment with four plastic bags and
well,
a falling
I was gonna
apart one from the co-op
them.
In Santa Monica.
That's something, too. That's one of my biggest passions. And I'm glad I did teach you some of that. That's the earth.
Did.
To be good to the earth. My favorite story was when we were driving. I made up a big sign that's put by the window of the car that said, "You're polluting." And we put it up. Your job at 3 was to hold up the sign to big diesel trucks were spewing black smoke. And we stopped at a light and you opened the window and said to the truck driver, "You're polluting." And he said, "What?" Then you said it again. He said, "Oh, I am. I thought he was going to come and turn the car over." Big, muscly, red-faced guy. He said, "Well, I'm going to go to get that fixed right now."
Oh. See, you've taught me to be an environmentalist from a young age.
Yeah.
It's a very important part, I think, of what we're trying to do.
We don't want to get too political, but we've got to get rid of Mr. Pruitt.
Your favorite person.
And everybody else involved. It's all going to come. It's going to, you know, too much progress has been made. And I just read that all these things he spouts on about, half of them, he's doing them so ineptly that the courts are fighting him, the judges are pushing him down. I don't think he's going to get half of it accomplished.
I've never really understood why not protecting the environment.
They all have children.
Exactly.
Grandchildren.
I don't understand why that's a partisan issue.
And cancer is such an epidemic. It's, you know, it's so much of it has to do with our pollution and plastics in the ocean and fish gobbling up the plastics. I don't even want to eat fish anymore.
Yeah.
I think we all have to strive to become more plant-based, which you've done so credibly with your...
Not always.
No, but I mean those recipes.
Everybody thinks I'm vegetarian.
Yeah,
everybody thinks I eat like... a sheet of nori and
no, you make it clear that you
cashew cheese and shit I would never eat.
But your recipes are so good. Why can't I ever open them up? I'm such a dope when it comes to the internet.
Oh, yeah, we've got to get you a little more tech savvy. Maybe for Mother's Day, I'll get you a class with an IT person.
Oh, it'll go right in one ear and out the other.
I don't
know
that that's true. From my standpoint, you have had this amazing life. Not that it's always been easy, but you have these wonderful friends and children who love you and grandchildren who adore you. And You've had this incredible career. And I just wonder, what do you, are there things left that you still really want to accomplish?
You know, I'm happy to say that I really, really like my own company, and I've become a bit of a hermit, which I have to be careful of.
I got to get you on J-Date.
Oh, no, no. I would be
happiest. I got to get you on Tinder, Mom.
Right. I'd just be happy being with my grandkids and a few friends I have. I've never been a big social person.
It's true.
I admire it, and I love watching you, and I love being with your friends. That's some of the most fun I have, being around all your colorful, fun friends. And I love your girlfriends in the time, kindergarten and Spence, high school. That is very fulfilling. And some of them have become my good friends, you know?
So sweet.
I've never been really ambitious. I don't have great plans to do other roles.
There's not one that you haven't done yet.
No, I think being a part of a theater company and being on stage from the beginning, that's what I love to do, is be in a company. And, you know, in the last film I did with a couple that I've done with Brett Haley, he has a little repertory company now.
That was fabulous. Do you want a boyfriend?
No.
Mom, Jake and I want you to have a boyfriend.
I have no interest. Really, I don't. You know what? Okay. If I got my heart broken, I'd probably jump off of the railing.
Oh, okay.
And I don't want to be bored. So it's one or the other.
I can also go to goop.com and get you a vibrator.
We
can
leave it. Thanks very much, but no thanks.
Is there anything else you want to add?
No, I've just said I can't get over you, and that you wanted to talk to me. I'm thrilled, as
what
I said.
What do you mean?
It's hard to get you on the phone, so I'm glad I got you here.
It's hard to get you to open up.
Did I?
You did.
Good.
Well, thank you for coming and doing this.
Okay, well, thank you, sweetheart.
I love you.
I love you.
Happy Mother's Day.
I love you more.
I love you more.
Thanks so much for tuning into this conversation with Gwyneth and Blythe Danner. Next week, we'll be back with a new episode.
This has been a presentation of Cadence 13 Studios. I hope you'll listen, follow, rate, and review all of our episodes, which are available for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Odyssey, or wherever you get your podcasts.